At 75, she was tall, angular, and still strong. Her maiden name had been Christensen. She was of Viking pioneer blood. Her blonde hair had turned white. She cut it herself in an old-fashioned, practical Dutch bob. She refused to wear glasses, except for reading. Her faded blue eyes were like those pale fish that swam in the dark recesses of underground caverns, keeping their dark prehistoric secrets to themselves. The sun had thickened her skin and coated it with liver spots. Of this she was proud. How much better it was than the transparent, fragile flesh of her contemporaries. In her old age, her clothes, like Newman's, had become costumes. In the daytime, around the chalet, or for trips into Shady Cove, she dressed in an old paint-spattered monkey suit, which her husband Eddie had used for chores. Outdoors, she wore a pair of Big Mac men's boots, nicely broken in. Indoors, a pair of old Indian moccasins. When she entertained company, she blossomed out in a diurnal skirt from Greece, a Peruvian llama sweater, a red Spanish shawl over her shoulders, long earrings, and silver bangles on her spotted arms. She dotted her leathery cheeks with rouge and mascaraed her eyes, but she did not believe in lipstick. In both costumes, she walked with a forthright stride, one foot after the other, a kind of mad purpose blazing in her eyes. In her youth, before she married Eddie Butterwick, she had taught school up in Bridgeport. She had walked 3 miles to and from her parents' home to the small country schoolhouse every day. The first lesson in the morning, following this walk, was always calisthenics. Deep breathing and proper elocution she considered important. Her ambition had been to become an actress. For years after her marriage, and while she brought up her 2 daughters, she had organized and participated in the Norton Little Theater Group. Her brightest role had been Portia. She still knew most of the lines. But marriage had dragged her down. Younger people gradually took over the little theater, and she was relegated to minor roles. After having been assigned the part of a shepherdess in As You Like It, she wrote a haughty note and resigned. Eddie had never made much money. He was in insurance, but he had an uncle who had made a fortune in lumber. Just in time to fill the void left by the little theater, this uncle died, leaving his money to Eddie and the chalet to Hilda. He had never liked Hilda, but as he approached death, he realized that she alone would do honor to his house in the woods. His will read, "She will appreciate its character." Hilda did. The chalet was modeled on a German hunting lodge. It was adorned with mounted animal heads, moose, elk, buffalo, deer, and the brittle varnished corpses of steelhead and salmon. Stuffed small animals and birds perched on bookshelves and end tables. An oil painting of a Modoc Indian chieftain in full war regalia hung over the great stone fireplace. The chalet's drafty, raftered rooms, furnished with Navajo rugs and Indian trinkets, seemed made for an ancient warrior king. Its site, over the wildest riffle on the rogue, was splendidly savage. Hilda made Eddie move into the chalet, though his insurance business was in Norton, 25 miles away. Moreover, she refused to permit him to wire it for electricity. At night, she lit the kerosene lamps herself. Stalking from room to room, her shadow against the wall was like a giant priestess performing a magical rite. For the first time in her life, she felt her environment suited her. She was mistress of an establishment, not just a house. Unfortunately, Eddie was not around long enough to enjoy their altered circumstances. He died, leaving Hilda wealthy. When Hilda was first widowed, her daughters in California suggested she move back into town. By way of answer, she instituted her famous chalet Sunday brunches, feasts of kippered salmon, creamed fin and haddie, broiled kidneys, blueberry muffins, and 3 kinds of homemade jam. John came early and made the gin fizzes. Until this time, she had not believed in strong drink. John weaned her on the gin fizzes, and she went on to become a connoisseur of bourbon, buying Jack Daniels in cases, which she stored in the attic. One never knew who might turn up at her brunches. She asked whoever caught her fancy, without regard to their social position or how they would mix with the other guests. The David Hinks, Hinks Department Store, and the Carter Smiths, Rogue Orchards, and Dr. and Mrs. Story mingled with Bill Blair, who ran the Shady Cove gas station and did odd chores for her on the side, and Muriel Burke, the waitress from Benny's Cocktail Lounge and Riverside Cafe. The guests were allowed to fish or merely sunbathe on her deck, but they had to respect the spirit of her gatherings. They had to love the river and appreciate the chalet. Moreover, the conversations had to be on a high plane, involving either local natural history, of which she was an authority, or reminiscences of her past successes as an actress. The conversation, however, did not preclude gossip, which she drank in greedily, as if she had been deprived of it at some important stage in her development. This was true. She had always scorned the personal and the trivial. Now, suddenly discovering it, as she had booze, she began to manipulate people in order to create situations. Capriciously, she would drop an acquaintance and add another. Her sense of drama gave the brunches a further dimension. People came as they would come to the theater, to be surprised. But she was not made to enjoy her triumphs. A kind of reaction set up inside of her. She began to sense slights, suspect treacheries. When her guests left, she would stalk the veranda, complaining to a contented, well-fed John of their stupidity, their shallow natures. Why did she bother? Why did she slave? They came only to feed their faces. There was nothing inside their brains. Since John came too, partly for this reason, he remained tactfully silent. But perhaps she suspected treachery here too, for at this time she began her jaunts around the world. She traveled alone.